You're listening to WRIR LP 97.3 FM, and this is Open Source RVA. This week on Open Source RVA, we talk with Angela Dews, president of the Richmond Education Foundation, and Dana Schrad, executive director of the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police. They respond to Governor Bob McDonald's suggestion to arm teachers in response to last week's school shooting in Connecticut. And we tour the Garden Festival of Lights at Lewis Ginner Botanical Garden with PR director Beth Monroe. But first, here's some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. Former Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum announced through his Patriot Voices PAC his official endorsement of current Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli for governor. Santorum names Cuccinelli a dear friend and extols his commitment to general Republican platforms such as overturning Obamacare and cutting government spending, but also Cuccinelli's social conservative stance, though not mentioned specifically in the endorsement. Both Cuccinelli and Santorum oppose same-sex marriage, hold staunch pro-life views, and have stated that they believe climate change to be a hoax. Open Source RVA reported first on the ouster of Firehouse Theater Project founder and artistic director Carol Pearson on Wednesday. Yesterday, as online outrage over Pearsall's ouster boiled over, the four other co-founders of the organization lent their approval to a planned rally in support of Pearsall, to be held tomorrow from 5 to 6 at the November Theater, formerly the Empire at 114 West Broad Street. In interviews with board members, Open Source has learned that board member Joe Kennedy, tapped as likely to take over as the new president of the institution after June 30th, had made removal of Pearsall a condition of her own continued involvement with the theater company. Kennedy retired in 2010 from her decade-long post as head of the Visual Arts Center of Richmond. According to two people in attendance at the board's emergency meeting on Sunday, December 9th, Kennedy read aloud the contents of a multiple-page email that included her ultimatum. The reason for Pearsall's ouster has yet to become publicly known, though Pearsall and the theater's new managing director, Jeannie Mallory, who'd been hired earlier this summer, had clashed frequently over operations at the theater. The Monday following the board's emergency meeting, Pearsall and Mallory participated in a mediation session. That session, according to emails obtained by Open Source, appeared successful based on an email from current president Kay Holmes, who wrote to Carol that she thought there is a middle ground and that everyone will be able to work effectively and happily with the continued success of Firehouse as the goal. The next day, at its regular monthly meeting, the Firehouse board voted to end Pearsall's employment as of June 30, 2013. John Beliles is now officially the winner of this year's race for the 1st District City Council seat. He beat the incumbent Bruce Tyler by just 22 votes on election night. Tyler filed suit contesting the results, and a recount ensued. This time, Beliles won by a mere 20 votes. One was changed to Tyler and another thrown out, according to Beliles. This weekend sees the return of the annual holiday event, Scala Days, a two-night sound explosion of ska, punk, reggae, and funk that will take over Strange Matter for a worthy cause, to support Tricycle Gardens, which works to maintain sustainable and healthy food options in Richmond. Tonight and tomorrow night, you can hear bands such as The Pie Tasters, Murphy's Kids, Patent Pending, Tsunami Rising, and Aquafuture. Canned food and warm blankets will be collected for the homeless. Each show begins at 5 p.m., and you can get more information by going to strangematterrva.com.
The senseless killing of 20 Connecticut elementary school children and six of their teachers on December 14th has cast a sobering pall on holiday celebrations that are traditionally so focused on the joys of childhood. They died defenseless in their classrooms before the rage of an allegedly mentally ill young man who killed but left few clues to his reasons. It seems inevitable as we seek sense in the senseless that the search should turn to politics. We live in a country that is house-proud and hasty to defend the inalienable rights bestowed on us by our forefathers. But we also live in a nation that this week is a house divided on the meaning of one of those rights. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. earlier this week responding to the predictable flurry of legislative and lobbying efforts to either regulate or deregulate guns, Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell weighed in on what may prove to be among the most controversial of the ideas floated by gun rights advocates as a reaction to anti-gun foes. McDonnell said everything is on the table, including evaluating an idea to arm classroom teachers. Yesterday, he established a task force to study this and other school safety ideas. I'm with Angela Dews, president of the Richmond Education Association, who represents more than 1,800 teachers in Richmond Public Schools, and with Dana Schrod, executive director of the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police and the Virginia Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators. Ladies, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking.
A tough topic at Christmas time to be talking about. And again, I guess really what is so interesting, I guess, as we're trying to grapple with this, is this latest wrinkle in Virginia is the idea of arming teachers. And it's become something that's the nation is talking about now, too. Mm-hmm. I guess I'd love to start with Angela. What is the REA's position on this?
We think that the role of a teacher is to educate the children, is to teach them how to become productive citizens. We spend so much time with the children that it's hands-on, it's one-to-one. I mean, kids are around you all the time, that we don't think that that is a teacher's responsibility to carry a gun, to be armed in the classroom.
I would imagine that it would present different problems for different levels of teacher. As somebody who's an elementary teacher, where children want to hug.
Kids hug you. They don't have an idea early on of personal space. So they're underfoot all the time. They're bumping into you. They want attention. They need this. They need that. They're like obstacles. It's like an obstacle course, in the classroom with the smaller children and the book bags and, the different things.
And it's an obstacle course with lots of little fingers, too.
Right. Fingers, and they're pulling, and they look. And if you have something in your desk or on your desk, you constantly have to say, this is mine, don't touch this. Or what are you're trying to figure out what are they doing, who's missing. But, I mean, that's a part of school. That's a part of school, and we're there to teach them academics, reading, writing, arithmetic, science, history, and how to grow up to be good citizens. We're not there to teach them gun control or for that to be a part of their learning experience of school.
Now, high school, again, there's a completely different dynamic there.
Different dynamic, but still the same. They expect to be safe in school. They don't expect the teacher to have a gun. They come to school so they can be safe to escape the guns in the neighborhood or at home if they know a parent has a gun or whatever. It's the same thing. They expect to learn a safe learning environment. And even in high school, they bump into you, they walk by you, they pick up things. Kids are kids. They're curious about certain things, but they expect to be safe. And they don't expect me to teach them how to defend yourself or to be afraid of a gun and that type of thing.
Right.
It's just an idea that just doesn't make sense to me as a teacher that I should or be allowed to have a gun in school for protection.
Dana, has your organization taken any sort of a position or how do you personally feel on the topic?
Well, we've actually crossed this particular issue in the past after the Virginia Tech incident, because it became a legislative initiative on part of several legislators to presume that maybe the path that we should take would be to arm professors, let professors bring guns to school, especially those who have concealed weapon permits. And our campus police chiefs have always opposed that because there's so many reasons, for that. And really, it's the same in the K-12 environment. When you come to college, you come there to learn, and the role of the professor is to be an educator. And I think the biggest concern that I have really around this, and our police chiefs feel very strongly, they support the position of the educators, that just as the role of teachers is to be educators, the role of law enforcement is to be protectors, defenders, and to respond to the scene of a crime and to take on that particular responsibility during a time of crisis. They're the ones authorized under our laws to use lethal force. And when you start transferring that responsibility to someone who's trained as a professional educator and say, oh, by the way, now we expect you to be ready to use lethal force and be ready to size up a situation and determine whether or not to take the life of someone else, you're asking them to do something that is outside of their professional responsibility.
Were some of these issues not debated during the assembly session where we were talking about the idea of arming professors?
Or? Yes, and that's why we've been able to defeat every year. Now, I know that bill is going to be back this year. And once again, I think there are knee-jerk reactions that occur. People presume that, well, if we all carried a gun, then we could, you know, protect ourselves. There is a big difference legally between me protecting my household as a private citizen if someone were to invade my home, as opposed to someone who is a public employee paid for by taxpayers, expected to serve in a certain role, then stepping outside that role to perform the duty of another public actor, which in this case would be law enforcement.
And there really are myriad issues that crop up when you start thinking about the idea of putting a gun into somebody's hand, I guess a police officer's hand even. Once that gun is in his hand, he has a higher level of responsibility as a citizen, and he also has a higher liability as an employee.
The key difference is training. The key difference is you may be someone who has very good shooting skills as a private citizen, but you haven't been trained in shoot-no-shoot scenarios that law enforcement has been trained in. And you talk to any law enforcement officer who has been through judgment training, and they'll tell you time and again when they go through those scenarios, they very often, in those mock setups, shoot the innocent citizen and don't even realize it until afterwards. It's a very tough call to make in a time of crisis to determine who's the armed perpetrator and who's the armed defender. And to put that responsibility on educators is way outside of their responsibility, their professional training. That's what we train our police officers to do.
Now, one of the things in talking with other law enforcement folks in the last day or so about this is an issue that cropped up for me immediately. I was thinking, well, you know, for the people inside of the building, how they're going to handle their weapons, I suppose. But then what law enforcement folks have pointed out is police officers coming, responding to a school if there were a shooting or a report of a shooting, and they arrive on scene and they're entering the building and they don't know what the scenario is at this point. And I guess if you wanted to take over and explain what is happening when a police officer arrives on scene.
Well, it's chaos. You know, it's very often chaos, and particularly in a setting like we had in the elementary school in Connecticut, you have young children, you have teachers, you have a traditionally very safe environment now shaken to its core by this act of violence. And people are pretty much in shock at that point in time. And the way you react, for police officers, you react based on your training. And so if an officer comes into the building and he's looking for that armed perpetrator, he's looking for the person who is acting like a perpetrator, and you're going to shoot first because you're going to try to protect the citizens around you. You don't always know who that volunteer defender is. If you don't know who the principal is or the janitor or the school teacher or whoever else works there in the building, or maybe if it's even a third party, maybe it's a visitor who's come into the building who's trying to help defend. You don't know who that person is. And a lot of times innocent persons are killed. Those third parties are killed trying to help. Even police officers, when they've arrived at shootings, sometimes we've had plainclothes officers show up at a shooting.
You mentioned somebody earlier that was in Virginia Beach.
In the Hampton Roads area, I believe in Norfolk, who was basically came to the scene and was shot by a fellow police officer and killed. They didn't know at the time. It was dark. It was the person was unannounced, and it happens. And those are tragic incidences. You don't want to put that responsibility on an educator.
I'm with Angela Dews, who's the Richmond Education Association president, and with Dana Schrod, who's executive director of the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police and also the Virginia Association of Campus Law Enforcement Officials or Administrators?
Administrators, correct.
Administrators. Angela, for you inside the building on a day-to-day basis, you do have fights. We were talking a bit ago about the tactile nature of children.
Mm-hmm.
You have fights, too. One of the things that's sort of, I guess, for me puzzling over is how, I guess, a teacher reacting to just a day-to-day incident, how that dynamic might change if they had a weapon now.
I couldn't imagine that, having a weapon with me in the classroom. On the few instances that I've had fights in my classroom or in the hallway, you call for, you tell them to stop because you're obligated to tell them to stop. Some teachers jump in and try to pull them apart, but you're obligated to tell them to stop. But you're also obligated to keep the other kids safe. So you're doing damage control. You're keeping everybody back, you know, stay back, you know, get away from them, that type of thing. I remember I taught at John Marshall, and there was an incident probably about 5 or 6 years ago. And we were upstairs. It was during one of the lunches. And so we were upstairs, and I looked out on the front lawn. There were all these police cars. We didn't know what had happened in the cafeteria, but there was a fight, and I mean, were numerous fights, and so the police were called. And so then when they did let the kids come upstairs, we still didn't know what was going on, but our instinct was to just bring them in your room and keep them safe. That's all I want to do. Just come here. You didn't know who they were. They were indifferent. I didn't even have my kids for my period, but they were like, I was like, come in, because you want to keep them safe. I couldn't imagine doing anything else besides keeping those kids safe.
Now, since Columbine, there have been protocols put in place for during incidents like this, mm-hmm. or where there might be an intruder, and those do include bringing children into the classrooms, locking the classroom door. Often you're supposed to have something over the windows so you can't see what's inside of that classroom, right?
Yeah, there are different plans for different schools. I was when Columbine occurred, I was teaching in Henry County at a middle school, and I didn't know anything had happened until I came home, was watching the news. And it just drove me crazy the next day when I went to school. I'm like, what would we have done besides try to keep the kids safe and hidden, just like last week with those elementary kids? But me having a gun is not the answer. We have school security. If anything, they need to have more training. They don't have a lot of rights. They don't carry weapons. They can't do but so much restraint. But if you're going to train anybody that needs to for protection or for added security, it will start with the school security.
Now, here we're talking Richmond Public Schools has their a separate security force or organization within Richmond Public Schools.
Right.
And they do work the security desks at
the
front.
They work the desks. We have some schools that have metal detectors, so they work the metal detectors, roam the halls to make sure that everything is safe throughout the day.
Now, this is, I guess, one of the things that, again, you start to sort of think about as you hear this idea of armed teachers or armed administrators or whatever, is right now we do have some things in place. We've had school resources or resource officers in the past. These are either sheriff's deputies or police officers who are in the schools, or again, Richmond Public Schools and many other districts will have security on staff. But again, budget cuts are eroding many of those things. DARE officers we were talking about earlier, the budget federal grant money has sort of disappeared. So that's eroded some of what was in place with DARE, which again, were police officers or deputized sheriff's officials.
They would come in and teach the elementary kids about safety and protection and drugs. I mean, they had a role model, an authority figure who carried a gun, who they knew were trained to do these type of things. It wasn't teachers. We didn't do that.
But there are fewer of these people too now. And if we're talking about the idea of bringing somebody back into the school who is going to be this security figure or security guard, we're doing it in a time when there's precious little money to go around.
Right.
I guess what sort of challenges might that present?
Well, we've had a fair amount of federal and state grant funding. In the past, we were able to put school resource officers in the middle schools and the high schools. School resource officers have not been a common fixture in the elementary schools. And the reason being is school resource officers are really there to be that first line of defense, that first a form of assistance in the school should something happen. But they also provide a variety of other services in the schools, usually in terms of crime prevention, in terms of oftentimes they serve as officers that
counseling.
Young people can come and talk to. Exactly. But at the elementary school, you never really worried about whether or not you needed someone there to provide that level of security because, frankly, teachers could handle kids that age. Teachers are also, many of them receive training in how to defuse a situation just as law enforcement officers do. You know, lethal force is not the first answer most of the time. The incident that we had in Connecticut, thank goodness, is a very rare occasion. If this kind of event were happening frequently, routinely, we'd be talking about another strategy here. But it's the rare occasion. So if you were to take that and treat that Connecticut situation as if that were the norm in our society, then we would be turning our schools into armed fortresses. Mm-hmm. And that's not the kind of environment that is healthy for education. You don't want children to be fearful about their lives. And so that's really not the kind of environment that's conducive to a wholesome school setting. And that's, I think, why the teachers feel that this would change the world that they're working in. However, if we can bring school resource officers back into our high school and middle schools, that would be very helpful. There are other things that can be done as well. I mean, there's certainly some structural design issues that need to be addressed in some schools. Schools who aren't very good about protecting their entrances, and they haven't, you know, made sure that everyone comes in through the first front entrance. Now, obviously, they did everything right from what we can tell in Connecticut. And you had a perpetrator there who was off the chart, something we haven't seen before. If it appears that one of the resolutions might be to try to put school resource officers in elementary schools on a daily basis, it's certainly something that can be tried, but it's an expensive proposition. But mental health services is something that's a critical need here. It's the elephant in the room.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing. And again, real quick, I'm talking with Dana Schrod, who I'm going to give one title for. She's the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police Executive Director, and Angela Dew, she's president of the Richmond Education Association, is, again, going back, this mental health issue, the elephant in the room. This guy, he came to the school. He appears now, the media reports on this have been, frankly, is kind of embarrassing for media, I think, once they come back and start to examine themselves. But here nor there, you have a situation where this person, who really was an exceptional situation, comes to the school. He has mental issues that are apparently untreated, or that services had fallen off after he left school. And this is a common issue with mental health care, is after high school, where there is that big right. hug that is the government's big hug, really, those services fall off and there's very little for some people.
Right. Being a special education teacher, I know you have a lot of wraparound services in school.
The big hug.
But once, and you try to educate the students and their parents on what's available out after they graduate. Or after they finish high school.
But you can't force it.
You can't force it. And unfortunately, a lot of the mental health agencies are overwhelmed because the lack of funding. And, you know, they have large caseloads. And so they can't reach everybody that they need to. If I know, as a caseworker, I know you need services, but you're not reaching out to me, I don't always have the time to come find you.
Would you have the authority to?
Not really, because they're adults. You know, they're adults. And unfortunately, until something bad happens and it's mandated, whether they're in prison or they go to a facility, a mental health facility by a court order, you can't make people take medicine.
Our law enforcement officers know of a number of people in our communities who have sort of fallen through the cracks. You can ask any police officer in the Metro Richmond area, and they'll tell you about someone they know who's mm-hmm. homeless, who's in need of mental health services, but who has basically fallen out of the system, doesn't want help, is paranoid about anybody who would
right.
come to that person and try to help. And they just keep an eye on them, but they can't force them into any kind of services. And most of them are not dangerous. It's just sad that they're living, you know, at poverty level. They're living without any kind of support services, mental health assistance. But you never know which one is really got problems that they may act out.
And this is an interesting dynamic that is sort of, I guess, highlighted in this situation, where mental health issue is becomes sort of the catalyst of this, perhaps. It becomes almost, again, a stigma, more of a stigma now. They're dangerous. In fact, the former head of the Virginia State Police sort of said so in his statement to the media about all of this. He said that, you know, people experiencing mental health issues, if they're going to do these unspeakable things, the next thing that I think you have to consider is being able to mitigate it when they get into the schools. Well, I mean, it seems like mitigating should happen maybe before they become an issue.
Yeah, prevention services are very difficult because, once again, you know, we live in a free society. If someone doesn't want help, you can't force it on them, especially
right.
when they're an adult. It's one of the reasons why one of the only recourses often is involuntary civil commitment for services. But even then, involuntary commitment is only for a period of hours, up to 72 hours. And after that, someone has to be then committed for a longer period of care. And without proper insurance coverage or without the mental health beds that are appropriate to that person's needs, we often have to let them go back into society being underserved.
So are there alternatives to what's being suggested here?
Well, there's a lot of things we can do. I mean, we've talked about doing more threat assessment training in the community to work with between mental health. The three legs of the stool really are mental health, law enforcement, and the schools, especially with the population that's K through 12, to try to make sure that those three units are working together and sharing the information that they can without invading the privacy of the individual, because oftentimes we can't share certain types of information across those disciplines. But if we can, to help, you know, monitor the needs of a family, the needs of a child, to make sure that we're maybe preventing a criminal act from occurring by making sure that the person is receiving the services they need, then that it's an expensive proposition, and it's difficult to get the funding we need to address a problem that hasn't happened yet. But after it happens, it's certainly inexpensive, and sometimes, like in the case in Connecticut, there is no way to pay back those families for their losses.
Angela, any final thoughts on
The same thing. I think if you're going to do something for educators, is to give them more knowledge on how to handle a crisis situation. Give us more information about mental health services. But I think to give me the authority to carry a gun, I don't think, as a teacher, that's not the answer.
All right. And again, thank you guys both very much. Angela Dews with the Richmond Education Association and Dana Schrod with Executive Director of the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police and the Virginia Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators.
My short title is Mom.
I'll take Mom. Mom, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
It's been said that Ebenezer Scrooge could have discovered the joy of Christmas just a little quicker, saving himself a lot of ghostly wear and tear if he'd just gone to the Lewis Ginner Garden Fest of Lights. Throughout the holiday season, 20 acres of Lewis Ginner Botanical Garden, just off of Lakeside Avenue, is transformed into a wonderland of winter wattage. The impressive display in one of the prettiest parts of the region has become a rite of passage for Richmonders during the holidays. Beth Monroe's with us today. She's the Public Relations Director at Lewis Ginner, and we're going to talk about why, during the holidays, Richmond is drawn to the lights, whether it's the tacky variety or the more thoughtful kind on display at Ginter. Welcome and thanks for coming.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for your kind words about the lights and not including us in the tacky list.
Well, you know, you do have a lot of lights, and I guess I should start with, do you ever blow a fuse?
Well, I that's a good question. I know we do, but they are fast to fix that,
right,
and to get those lights back shining.
And you have Dominion on your side too, so I'm sure
there's a
technician on call.
Yeah, we have the speed dial.
right.
No, it is Dominion Garden Fest of Lights. They are the sponsor of the show.
Well, how many bulbs are we talking about here? How many lights?
We're talking about 500,000 lights. Now, I don't count them all, you know, give or take a few.
But that's the approximate number.
That's the approximate number.
Wow. And are more lights added each year? Is it pretty much the same each year? How does it work?
Well, we do try to add more lights each year. And one of the other things that's really cool that we do is that we're transitioning to more and more LEDs. Mm-hmm. And right now, the show is approximately 95% LED lights.
Oh, okay.
And there are a number of reasons that that is good. Mm-hmm. One being is the LEDs are better for the environment. They use less electricity. They last longer. Mm-hmm. They do cost more up front, but with, you know, the advantages that I just mentioned.
Yeah, in the long run.
In the long run, the way to go is with the LEDs. And they also give a really much brighter, more vibrant color in the displays. And you'll really see that when you come out to Lewis Ginner Botanical Garden.
Well, the Garden Fest of Lights has become a real family affair. Give a little of the history of it. How did this Richmond tradition begin?
Well, we are still trying to figure out exactly when to start counting what was the first year of Garden Fest, because mm-hmm. I think it started fairly simply at first with trees and grasses and shrubs being uplit to really highlight the botanical features that we have out there. But in 1998, that is when Dominion came on board as the sponsor of the show. Mm-hmm. And, of course, with their involvement, it really put us into another realm with the light show. And ever since then, it has just grown mm-hmm. and grown. As I mentioned, Dominion is the title sponsor now of the show.
Right.
And, you know, we attract close to 70,000 visitors during that time frame with mm-hmm. the Dominion Garden Fest of Lights. It has truly become a Richmond and even a Central Virginia tradition for many, many people.
Right. Well, this year, the theme, you have special themes each year. The theme is East Meets West. What does that entail?
Right. Well, each year we do have a theme, and what we try to do is to choose a theme that will help us highlight and talk about what's new or what's the next big thing at the
mm-hmm.
garden.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the new things that's coming up is that we are planning a cherry tree walk around Lake Sidner on our property.
Right.
And so this will give us the opportunity with the East Meets West theme to really educate and inform people about the fact that we have this opportunity, that we are planting species from eastern countries, and also just the fact that so many of the plants that we have in our landscapes now that we take for granted and probably assume, you mm-hmm. know, that perhaps they're native to our area,
right.
are really natives of Japan and China and eastern countries. So, you know, our mission is focused on education,
mm-hmm.
and we try to do that as much as possible. Sometimes, you know, it's not just with classes and that type of thing. Sometimes it's just as simple as having a really cool theme during
yeah.
Garden Fest of Lights.
Yeah, the I guess you use the Garden Fest event to highlight the garden itself.
We do, yes. And this year with the East Meets West theme, in addition to lights that are, you know, in designs of Eastern design, like a large dragon and that type mm-hmm. of thing, and the botanicals that, again, are fashioned along those Eastern themes, we also are uplighting and highlighting the plants
mm-hmm.
that are Eastern native. So when you
right.
walk through the show, you will see trees, grasses, mm-hmm. bushes, shrubs that are uplit, and some signage that explains what you're seeing. So in that way, if you pardon the pun, we're really staying true to our roots.
Oh. Well, I said up front that 20 acres of the approximately 20 acres are being used mm-hmm. for the Garden Fest of Lights. How big is the total garden? How large is Lewis County?
The garden is just over 80 acres of
wow.
you know, the property,
mm-hmm.
and about 50 of that is landscaped areas,
mm-hmm.
And then, like you mentioned, approximately 20 are used with the Garden Fest of Lights show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have some water features, a lake, and some other areas that are really great because we can take advantage of the reflective qualities of
sure.
the water, and
uh-huh.
that sort of doubles the intensity of the lights. But, yeah, about 20 acres of it are decorated with the lights.
For people who don't know, give just a little short history of the garden and how it came to be.
Mm.
It was actually 1984
mm-hmm.
when it finally settled on being what it is today, right?
Yes. I mean, it really is quite a long and involved history,
mm-hmm.
and probably a lot of people.
We could actually just do a show on that history, actually.
We could. It's almost like a
labyrinthian.
A soap opera
uh-huh.
or a
yeah.
drama. Yes, well, you know, Lewis Ginter did own the property back in the late
18th. War hero, a businessman.
Businessman, entrepreneur, I mean, a fascinating character
mm-hmm.
in himself. And a you know, a Richmonder that, again, probably if people knew more about him, would
mm-hmm.
be really
mm-hmm.
even more fascinated to learn. But the property that he owned there was actually the Lakeside Wheel Club.
Mm.
And a wheel club.
It was a bicycle club.
Bicycle
club.
Club.
Right.
Yeah. And those big wheel bicycles
uh-huh.
with
oh,
the
right.
big wheel in the front. And so the gentleman in the city would ride out to the country, mm-hmm. And they would...
that's what it was at that time. It was the country.
That was... exactly. Yeah. And that was, where they... kind of like a resort in that sense, where they would play cards or, mm-hmm. Spend time.
They had the water there, and yeah.
Exactly. So that was, the earliest history of the property. And then after Lewis Ginter died, his niece, Grace Arents, purchased the property, and she used it in a variety of different ways. One was as a hospital for sick children, mm-hmm. Especially children in the Oregon Hill area. They would, if they had breathing problems or conditions, they'd again take them out to the country, right. out there to what she then called Blumenthal Farm. And they would stay there. She helped found the Visiting Nurses Association. And mm-hmm. so once that was founded, there wasn't the need so much to bring the children out into the country for the fresh air. And she, Grace Arents, ended up living there in the house. She had a close friend who she gave life rights to the property, mm-hmm. to the house.
Here's where it gets complicated.
So then, and I'm going on and on, but after Grace passed away, her friend lived to be over 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And so for a very long time, not much was done there. And the will that Grace Arents left did leave the property to the city. And it just had to go through some legal,
Yeah, a lot of legal twists and turns, right?
A lot of legal implications. But in the end, a band of really dedicated volunteers mm-hmm. Got together, and they made sure that the will was followed, and the botanical garden was begun in 1984.
Right, and then not long after that, I guess, the Garden Fest mm-hmm. began.
Right, exactly.
Tell me about some of the side events that are planned for the Garden Fest this year. There's a Garden Fest for Fido? Was that what I did every day, right?
Well, yeah, some of our most popular events sometimes include our furry friends.
Right, that's something else Richmond likes. It's pets.
It does. And, the pet owners just seem so appreciative of mm-hmm. the opportunity to bring their pets out. So far, I think all we've had are dogs. We say leashed pets.
Right.
But we do have special evenings that we allow those, and we have one coming up in January. Mm-hmm. It's one of our last Thursdays of the show that we allow people to bring their leashed pets. And, staff and everyone just really enjoys seeing people come in with their dogs.
And also a New Year's Eve event?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
With live music?
That New Year's Eve event has really, really taken off.
Mm-hmm. This year you have Utilating Mummies, I think?
We do.
And
a Richmond favorite.
Right,
again.
Right.
And it's nice in the fact that it's very family friendly, mm-hmm. very family oriented. So people come during the day. It's an afternoon event. And then they can stay and enjoy the lights afterwards.
Oh, okay.
So, there's not a whole lot, really in town sometimes to do with the kids and families,
yeah.
especially during the day on mm-hmm. that day. And so it's really found a niche there. And there is one really cool thing that they do on that day. We have a terraced lawn that where it's sort of like an amphitheater-shaped area,
uh-huh.
and it's covered with grass. And so the kids, they roll in the new year because the kids love to roll down that hill. And so we have a little parade, and the kids,
oh, that's great.
They roll down the hill to the bottom
of the
hill.
Yeah, to heck with the lights. We want to roll down the hill.
So they roll in the new year.
Well, let's pull back and look at this widescreen a little bit. Why do you think we love lights so much? And I used to think this was a Richmond thing, but after mm-hmm. watching some of these television programs about the mm-hmm. obsessive tacky lights people, I wonder, why do you think it is that we love this during the holidays?
I'm still trying to figure that out myself, because it just seems that the interest in the lights never ends. I think it's a combination of the beauty, the dazzling quality of the lights, the color, the fact that it gets darker this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also about the experience of people doing something together.
Right.
And, especially with the show at Lewis Ginter Botanical Garden, it's a walkthrough show.
Mm-hmm.
So families come out. It's a crazy
they can
time
come at
of
their,
year.
They can do it at their own pace, which is what I appreciate about
exactly. And, yeah. you know, it's a time that they can really spend together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're so busy and running around doing our last-minute shopping and all of that. And to take a break and to come out and to do something as a family, mm-hmm. I think people really treasure that opportunity.
Right. A little contemplation at a busy and hectic time.
And also, if you've got family from out of town, it's a great way to get them out of the house.
That's a tip for you out there. The Garden Fest of Lights is going to run through January 7th,
mm-hmm.
right? And how do people get tickets and how much are they and mm-hmm. all that information?
Well, we have three ways that you can get tickets. You can get them in person. You can come to mm-hmm. the garden and purchase those. You can get them online, or you can also call in. The online and the phone, there is a small service charge.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, again, you can come by the garden anytime and get the tickets. We're open 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. these days. The only days we're closed are December 24th, 25th. And the tickets are $11 for adults, $10 for seniors, mm-hmm. and $7 for children ages 3 to 12, mm-hmm. and children under age 3 are free.
Okay, and it's lewisginter.org?
That's right, lewisginter.org. We have a lot of good information there, a lot of pictures. We even have a video.
Mm-hmm.
So if people want to get an idea of what, if they've never been before,
they
can come out and see.
Well, I'm Don Harrison, and we've been talking with Beth Monroe from Lewis Ginter Botanical Garden about the Garden Fest of Lights, which is running through January 7th. The theme this year is East Meets West,
mm-hmm.
and you can get more information at lewisginter.org. Happy holidays, Beth. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Don.
WRIR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, 804-771-5715 or www.kaufmanandknowles.com. Broadcast of WRIR is made possible in part by VCU Arts, a nationally ranked program featuring 16 visual, design, and performing arts departments, and a campus in Qatar, arts.vcu.edu.
Rick Alverson has been long familiar to Richmonders for his haunting, introspective music performed by his band Spokane, which gained an international following before going on hiatus in 2008. Since that project, Rick has been far from idle, and in fact has shown that his art is hardly platform-dependent. In 2008, he directed his first film, The Builder. In 2009, he took a giant leap forward, co-writing and directing with his frequent collaborator, Colm O'Leary, the stark and haunting New Jerusalem, about a war veteran struggling for meaning and finding something akin to friendship with a Pentecostal devotee played by Will Oldham. But the past 2 years have been an even bigger leap forward for Alverson, whose latest film, The Comedy, is set to christen Bowtie Cinema's new art house screen at the premiere weekend of Criterion Cinemas on December 28th. Sure to become a holiday classic in the same way that It's a Wonderful Life is considered the gold standard for World War II ensemble epics, one thing can be said with certainty about The Comedy. It provokes strong emotions. In the same month that it's made a handful of best-of lists with such high-profile film file publications as Slant and IndieWire, it's also been panned as being in bad taste by others. The Comedy is, as with almost everything Alverson has done, challenging art. Not intended to please, but certainly intended to provoke thought and conversation. And I'm here today with Rick Alverson. How you doing, Rick?
Hey, how's it going?
So, this is kind of exciting, I guess, getting to christen a big screen, I guess, here in Richmond.
It's nice to come home to a not a blanket anonymity,
or to pitchforks and
Well, those come after the screening.
All right. So this is it's a tough film, I guess, for a lot of viewers, and you've gotten really high marks for it. It's I mean, I've seen it a couple of times now, and it really is. It is a comedy.
No, it's not a comedy. Scratch that.
It's not a comedy.
No, it's not a comedy.
Well, how would you describe it? Tell me a little bit about
it. It's like a dystopian horror film. It can be read. People who have access to the kind of you know, dissonant, ironic engagement with the world that is present in the movie would comprehend the humorous audacity of certain situations. But ultimately,
maybe that's why I found it funny.
Yeah, that's right, because you're as corrupt as the protagonist. But you know, ultimately, it's meant to be a thorn in all of our sides and keep us up at night. And you know, I strongly believe in cinema as an active, wedge in our psyches that has some kind of purpose more than just an anesthetizing,
World War II ensemble film.
Well, I don't know. I think It's a Wonderful Life is an exception.
So no, but the film it does some interesting things to you when you're watching it. There are scenes in this movie that I guess the best way to put it is they verge on funny. And in fact, you have a comedian as your star.
Yeah, there's a lot of destabilization at work there in the thing. I mean, that's partially why it's caught some people off guard, and they've been, there's an engineered ambiguity to it, and we don't like that in our diet of American media. We like to know exactly, what's being served to us, and have ordered it on our terms. And this sort of is designed to remove some of those authoritarian controls of the viewer.
And your star again is famous to the blogosphere, internet world, and to MTV.
As Tim Heidecker.
And he's part of Tim and Eric
yeah.
team.
And Eric Wareheim's also in the movie. James Murphy from LCD Sound System was generous enough to show up and be subject to the experiment. And Greg Turkington, who people know as Neil Hamburger, plays a role outside of his typical persona.
So again, though, I guess what you've done is as you said, you sort of take these assemble these parts that people would assume are going to be funny, comedic. There are some elements of what you present that almost verge on funny. There are some scenes where you're waiting for the tension to break, which of course is how comedy happens. And when the tension breaks, it leaves you wishing that you'd put it all back. What ends up unfolding is just uncomfortable and terrible in some circumstances that you create.
I mean, it's meant to be a counterweight to the palatable, validating, comedy, drama, whatever dish we desire. I mean, that all ultimately just lets us leave the theater and not be troubled or moved, and it has no real resonance or use in our lives. It's better to keep somebody up all night long rather than intoxicate them into a stupor so that they're, the same dysfunctional mass of flesh that they were
you're not gonna fix that, Rick.
But I mean, it's a movies are a powerful thing. They always have been. People who are transformed or their perception of the world is physiologically interrupted. That's why, when we're young people, and even I think that, regardless of all of this veneer of intelligence that you and I and the rest of humanity pretends to wear after the age of 14, we're as subject to being altered and our behavioral perception affected, as adults as we are our children. And movies make the perception of the world that's on display in movies makes its way into legislation, I like to say, and that's a frightening thing.
So we're changed and become aware of universal stories at seven when we see Star Wars. We become aware of ourselves when we see Indiana Jones.
And our relationship to the world and it being a very oftentimes, a sanitized, categorized, simplistic view of the muddy, apocalypse of human interaction that exists in our daily life.
So what sort of reactions have you gotten outside of the critics? Because, frankly, critics don't really matter, right? But what kind of reactions have you gotten when you're talking one-on-one with somebody who's seen the film, not asking questions during a forum, but when it's somebody that, has seen this movie and afterwards you have those moments alone with them. What are they saying?
You know, I've had people, we had a screening up at Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York, and I had some young people being in their early 20s, you know, stop me a few days later, and you know, I think it's the success of it is that it does interrupt the way that we watch movies enough to put a wedge in people's the pace of their lives or mental activity, because it seems to be, you know, resonant for folks, which I think is all you can, you know, desire from these sorts of things.
In a strange way, it seems like there's almost an additional layer to some of this film's relevance, I suppose, with some of the violence we're seeing in real life right now. It's young white men in their, I guess, end of childhood, and they're still holding on to it and struggling with that and inflicting it on others around them, basically.
Yeah, it's funny how we utilize the idea of like a xenophobic kind of, you know, that the idea of the outsider or the foreigner is the great evil, and repetitively in our society it seems to be the, you know, the patriarchal stock, you know, demographic of the middle-aged or young white male that is the real splinter in society, you know. So as far as that goes, you know, the comedy explores a point of desensitization with a middle-aged white man.
You.
Me? No. I'm the protagonist.
And just for all of you out there, I'm with Rick Alverson, who is a local filmmaker whose film The Comedy is going to be...
Long-time Richmond resident.
Long-time Richmond resident and musician who's also a filmmaker. He's going to be premiering his film at the premiere opening of Criterion Cinemas on the 28th of December, just in time for coming down from the holidays. And Rick, you... can you talk a little bit about, I guess, just the home screen a little bit, the idea of getting to show your art here again to your, as you put it, long time home?
I mean,
and you have shown it. It's been shown in Richmond.
We showed it like one screen in a James River Film Festival.
That was earlier this year.
Yeah, but to have a commercial release in your hometown is a special thing. You know, we've played, I think this is going to be our 16th city, and we've done a lot of festivals, and it's been available on VOD, and, you know.
And you've done some big festivals as well, right?
Yeah, we premiered at Sundance, and we've done Rotterdam, and...
But Richmond is a different audience, I guess, too, than some place like a Sundance or a Rotterdam, where it's an anonymous sort of faces in the crowd. Here, you've got people you know, and I guess you've had the experience already a little bit with the James River Film Festival. But is that a different thing?
Well, I mean, the movie seems to divide along lines of what people want to utilize movies for. You know, I mean, if people are looking for a good time, then they probably should go elsewhere to some degree, depending on I suppose how corrupt their sense of humor is.
Well, the main theater is across the parking lot, luckily, right? So it's probably going to be something.
I mean,
else
it's a challenging movie, yeah. So, but
Why did you? First of all, I guess why did you switch from music? I've never asked you this. Why did you switch from music to movies? What was it that? Filmmaking.
My band, along with Bobby Donnie, longtime Richmond resident,
who's also been a collaborator of yours, right?
Yeah. He was in Spokane with me, and he was a co-writer on the comedy, and in bands such as Chris Dahl and La Bradford, and we explored a really narrow bandwidth. It was all about minutia, and like, it was very quiet. Project for five records, and I had wanted to, you know, I'd been to film school briefly in the early 90s and wanted to, you know, make a feature film before I turned 40, I suppose, you know. So I just got to work on that. It was interrupted the musical experiment.
You bring sort of a quietness, though, to filmmaking as well. It's not a complete departure.
I mean, the comedy probably, there's a lot of intentional flirtation with bells and whistles, loud noises, bright colors, and, you know, obscenity and things and in the comedy. But I think the
there's a lot of white space, too, though.
Right, yeah. And formally, it's there's a remove and a desire to be in, for both moral and, you know, like a conceptual remove and ambiguity and that sort of thing, which I think is related to, you know, a certain emotional remove in the music that I've, some of the music I've been involved in.
The film really goes with a very loose script, right? In fact, that's kind of your filmmaking technique.
No, it's a rigid script. It's just that there's no scripted dialogue. So then it, you know, so people, I think that, you know, we think of, you know, as the, like the literary sort of dialogue, spoken narrative, and as being the substance of a movie. And the movies that I've made have deal more with tone and you know, and action, and not that they're exciting, but
it's,
I mean, there are shifts in environment and in tone and relationship to,
well, it's a lot of emotional action in your films. Yeah. that both I've seen and I guess your music, it's the same thing. It's just kind of, it's about tension. It's what's in between the action in a lot of ways.
Yeah. There is hopefully a lot of tension. Yeah.
You're going to be, after the film, talking with the audience a little bit about some of these very things that we're talking about.
Probably Q&A type thing.
Probably better questions than what I've asked.
Well, we'll see.
And that's going to be both you and Bobby? Or,
well, if we can get him up there, yeah.
Okay, yeah, he's a quiet guy. So are you sometimes. And again, Rick Alverson, a local filmmaker, longtime Richmond resident, who has now 3 films and upcoming 4, possibly 5 under his belt. All of them have been, remarkable feats for somebody who was a musician just not too long ago, or at least we all knew him as one. And the most recent, the comedy, has premiered at Sundance and is getting lots of notoriety.
Distributed by Tribeca Film,
which can't be a bad thing. I think I've heard of that.
Just throw that
little thing called Tribeca Film. Thank you, Rick, for coming here.
Oh, thanks, Chris. Take care. It's a pleasure to be on this
holiday.
This great station. I haven't done it before. So
really, this is your first time on RIR.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming.
And that's our show for December 14th, 2012. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey, Amy Daniel, and Mike McKenzie. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi, and our board op is the not-so-ever-present Rachel Solomon. Hey, did you know that we podcast all of our episodes? Go to rvaopensource.com and get the lowdown. And stay tuned for next week's very special Christmas episode of Open Source RVA. We promise not to jump the shark. Until then, have a great weekend and be good to yourselves. This is Open Source RVA signing off.